From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. A community in Virginia is looking closely at its animal ordinances. One Wicomico County Council member observes the governing body did a good job of putting ordinances in place to protect people from dangerous dogs several years ago, but they hadn't done much to protect dogs from people who are irresponsible or cruel. That's according to the Delmarva Review. So the county is reconvening a dog review committee, this time to look at regulations through the dog's eyes. In the Cape Fear region, there are a smattering of animal rescue organizations. There are different dangerous dog ordinances from municipality to municipality. And there are vastly differing practices among residents across southeastern North Carolina, which ranges from broadly rural to urban to suburban when it comes to the care of companion animals. It was 2012 that the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office acquired Animal Protective Services. Today, we'll find out why that move was made, how it's working, and what the current standards are in Brunswick County. We'll explore why a new animal advocacy group has opened up shop there recently, and we'll also hear from one animal ethicist who studies the moral constructs that do exist or perhaps should exist in the relationships between humans and animals. Joining us today through the generosity of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which has opened their studios to us today, is Jeff Sebo. He earned his PhD in philosophy at New York University and is now a research assistant professor of philosophy. And he's the associate director of the Parr Center for Ethics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jeff Sebo, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us today, Mary Beth Mount. She is the vice president of Advocates for Animal Rights, which she recently launched in Brunswick County. Mary Beth Mount, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel. I appreciate your having me here.
And we're very glad to have with us Captain Mose Highsmith, Captain of Professional Standards and the staff attorney for the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office. Captain Highsmith, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And we'd like you to be a part of this conversation. If you have a question about the standards and protocols around the treatment of companion animals, you can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Mary Beth Mount, you launched Advocates for Animal Rights afar very recently in Brunswick County. Why? Why your own organization? Why not join forces with an existing animal organization?
Well, actually, I was not the person who launched this group. Kim Sherwood, who is a volunteer district area representative from the Humane Society of the United States, actually started this group, recognizing that in Brunswick County, we had a lot of animals that did not appear to be in homes in which they were being treated as humanely as they could be. So when Kim started the group, I am on the board of a group called Pawsability, and we raise funds to support the animal welfare groups in Brunswick County. The group came to our attention, and several of us went to the meeting. As a result, I kind of by default became the vice president, and we moved forward into talking about legislative issues. The one legislative issue that we felt we might be able to work with the Sheriff's Department to start out was the issue of tethering dogs. And we're not talking about tying your dog out for an hour while you're out doing your gardening. We're talking about dogs who live their entire lives on chains without adequate food and water and shelter. And we have seen this. I think many of us in Brunswick County, typically in the rural areas, have seen this going on. And we wondered if there were appropriate ordinances in place for the Sheriff's Department to solve these issues. And so that's when we started to work on this.
So going back to what Kim Sherwood observed and why she started this group, other than tethering dogs, can you sort of paint the broad picture of what kinds of practices she saw that she was so concerned about?
Well, I think tethering, it was the primary issue. I'm not honestly sure what the broader scope of what Kim had in mind when she started the group was, because when we first came together, that was the issue brought forward. But I think in general, all of us in the group are interested in improving the lives of the animals in our county.
Captain Mose Highsmith, what is the process for putting a new ordinance in place if, for instance, this tethering ordinance was going to move forward? And we'll talk about what that means and what different configurations of it could look like. But if it was going to move forward, how would that happen?
Okay. So someone would have to draft some language and propose it to the county commissioners. That generally goes by way of the county attorney who reviews it to try to make sure it's legally sufficient, meets all the necessary due process requirements, because any law that results in any kind of penalty, citizens are entitled to have their day in court. So the law has to, the ordinance is bound by the constraints of the Constitution.
And Jeff Sebo of UNC Chapel Hill, one of your areas of study and expertise is animal ethics. What does that even mean?
Animal ethics is a pretty broad category. We talk about animal minds and the moral and political standing of animals, what kinds of rights, if any, or protections, if any, they should have. And then we think about that issue in a pretty wide range of contexts. So we think about animals in agriculture, research, entertainment, companion animals, animals in our towns and cities, animals in the wilderness. And we think about what kinds of relationships we have, how we treat them, and how, all things considered, we think we should treat them and why.
And so if you narrow the focus to just companion animals and how, mm-hmm. how humans coexist with their companion animals, is there kind of a general standard of care that animal ethicists would say needs to be met, or is it just all over the map?
It's all over the map. You can never find philosophers or ethicists who agree about anything at all, including how we should treat companion animals. So there are some people who think that we should treat companion animals humanely and give them reasonably good lives, and in exchange we can have their companionship and have relationships with them. There are other people who think that since companion animals are in a state of vulnerability and dependence, that we should not bring that kind of domesticated animal into existence at all. So there are pretty wide range of views about how we should treat companion animals among philosophers and advocates.
Captain Highsmith, are there major differences in this area when we talk about the Cape Fear region and southeastern North Carolina? And I realize that you're an expert with the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office, but do you know if there are divergences in the way, say, New Hanover County might handle animal ordinances or the ordinances they have on the books versus Brunswick County?
I really can't speak to how New Hanover County handles their ordinances and don't really know the culture of New Hanover County and what they're experiencing. And I'm not sure that I'd say I'm an expert in anything in Brunswick County either, but I'm just happy to be here.
Why did Brunswick County decide to move Animal Protective Services over to the Sheriff's Office? What was that move about?
So when that happened, that was in 2012, and at the time, there were some personnel changes within the health department. That's where animal control used to lie. The director of the health department retired. A new person came in. And at that time, the county commissioners and the county manager approached the sheriff to see if he would have an interest in taking on the responsibility of animal control from the health department. And after all, if you're thinking about it, animal control being under the health department is, other than the rabies facet of it, is not a logical fit. Animal services involves investigations of animal cruelty and those kind of things, which is more an investigative function that the sheriff's office is equipped for. So the sheriff looked at those factors, felt that he could make a difference and could improve things under the sheriff's office, and so that's why it happened.
And that was 2012, so about 5 years ago.
Correct.
And how is that working? Do you think that there are more cases or more investigations into animal cruelty or animal welfare cases than there were before that?
I don't have numbers on on numbers of investigations, if I can venture a guess, I would have to say there are more investigations now because just the manpower structure is different than it was. I can tell you that when the animal shelter came or animal control function came under the sheriff, they had basically a live disposition rate of 17%, meaning...
What does that mean?
That means 17% of the animals, of all the animals that came into the shelter, 17% left the shelter alive, either adopted, returned to owners, however they left, breathing.
What happened to the others?
They were either euthanized, they died as a result of sickness and different things. Since animal control has been under the sheriff, that live exit rate, if you will, is now 60%. And so...
That's a big jump.
It's a big jump. It's certainly not perfect by any means. You know, we would love to be able to say we have 100%.
And what does the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office euthanize animals that don't get adopted out? What happens there? Is that part of the operation?
Well, there, you know, that's yes.
Okay.
The short answer is yes.
And I will let you expand on that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about the standards of care and the treatment of companion animals with the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office staff attorney, the vice president of Advocates for Animal Rights, and a UNC animal ethicist. If you have a question for our guests on this Thursday, the phone lines are now open. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're learning about how the study of animal ethics brings our treatment of companion animals into focus, why a new animal advocacy group recently launched in Brunswick County, and what the current ordinances are on the books in this largely rural county. With us today, Mary Beth Mount, vice president of AFAR, Advocates for Animal Rights of Brunswick County, Captain of Legal Affairs Mose Highsmith of the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office, and Jeff Sebo, Research Assistant Professor of Philosophy and the Associate Director of the Parr Center for Ethics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Captain Highsmith, just before we went to break, we were talking about how the rate of live release, animals who come into Animal Protective Services in Brunswick County, how that rate has jumped since it was moved under the auspices of the Sheriff's Office. You still euthanize animals, and you were going to expand on that before you were so rudely interrupted.
Well, you know, it's not an area that people want to hear expanded, probably. Euthanasia is not a nice subject to talk about. It's a necessary one. The Brunswick County Sheriff's Office, the Animal Control Section, doesn't euthanize animals because they're out of space. They don't euthanize animals based on their breed. If an animal, and they don't euthanize animals just because they've been in the shelter for too long. Once an animal makes it on to adoption road, we're committed to that animal, and we're gonna place it either through adoption within our agency. We're gonna use other animal advocacy groups and groups that come together to place animals.
And that's one of the reasons that this live release rate has jumped, because the sheriff's office is working with.
That's a huge reason. Commitment on the part of the sheriff to make sure as many animals as possible get adopted. If animals are euthanized, it's generally because they are sick, injured, unadoptable because of their behavior, not because of their breed. So I've just got to put a plug and tell a story if I have.
Please.
So back last year, one of our animal control officers went to a scene, and this person had been charged with animal cruelty offenses. She went back a couple of weeks later to do a follow-up to see how things were going, and one of the residents said, look, I need to tell you, we have this puppy that can't walk, and we used to take the animals and when they died, and we'd throw them over into the hog pen. Well, that was one of the reasons this person was charged. So the animal control officer said, okay, I'll take this animal and take it back and humanely euthanize it at the shelter. So when it got to the shelter, our shelter director, Captain Tommy Tolley, took a look at this puppy that was 8 weeks old and said, this puppy's got too much life to euthanize. And so he called me, my wife and I fostered the animal. He will be a year old March 24th.
Am I looking at a proud papa here?
You are. His name's Howie. He's been in physical therapy since he was 10 weeks old. So that's just an example of the commitment not to euthanize, if at all possible.
Mary Beth Mount with AFAR, you've been here 3 years now. How do animal welfare organizations work with the sheriff's office in Brunswick County?
Well, Brunswick County has a number of rescue organizations and a couple of independent shelters. And these groups, in working with the sheriff's department, pull animals from the shelter, take them into most of them are foster-based groups, put them in foster care. An animal in foster care is much more likely to be adopted because it's much better socialized. A foster parent can tell a potential adopter more about the animal and therefore making the placement much better. And so these groups pull animals, a lot of animals every year from the shelter to ease their burden and also help with adoption rates. And I think that's been a big help to the shelter in increasing their live release rates.
Jeff Sebo, Research Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC. Can you talk to us about this idea of adoptable animals and, say, through the lens of dangerous dogs? We know mm-hmm. that there are issues around that in terms of, you know, a culture, an area, heavily residential area, and how humans need to interact with dogs. That's been an issue, and some municipalities handle it by having dangerous dog ordinances. What does an animal ethicist have to say about that?
Yeah, so a lot of people do think that if a dog is sufficiently dangerous, then they might not be adoptable, and given space constraints, that might mean that they have to be as humanely as possible euthanized, and of course there are debates about that. And then the question becomes how you can minimize creating dogs who are dangerous or taking dogs who might not have been dangerous and causing them to become dangerous. And there are a lot of features of our practices with companion animals that might contribute to that. So, for example, the ways that we breed and transport and sell animals, we breed them industrially and transport them in isolation and sell them as commodities. And then people, of course, will neglect them or tie them up, leave them in isolation, and all of those things can contribute to dogs becoming more dangerous. And so one thing that we take a very close look at is what we can do earlier in the process to prevent this situation from arising in the first place so that we can spare ourselves from a really hard ethical choice. And then another thing that we talk about is what our standards of acceptable behavior are in the first place. So having a dangerous dog who might harm other human and non-human animals is one thing, but a lot of people hold non-human animals and domesticated animals like cats and dogs to higher standards than that. They not only want the animals to not be violent towards other people, but they also want them to not get in the way, not be disruptive, not bark too loudly, not knock things over. So we want to take animals and basically make them conform to human standards of etiquette. And that might be too high a standard for animal behavior. So another question that we look at is, what are the standards of acceptable behavior that we should be imposing on our animal companions in the first place?
So if we're talking, Jeff Sebo, about a community in Brunswick County, I think there are 19 municipalities in Brunswick County, and they're all very different kinds of places. Leland is a growing town, and it's sort of a suburban place, and there are other municipalities that are quite rural. Talk to those people who aren't looking down the barrel of, you know, people who aren't at a point of saying, I have a problem imposing my will on another sentient being. But people who are saying, who are looking at the difference between keeping a dog outside, say, during extreme weather versus, you know, how would you speak to a group like that in terms of what acceptable standards of care from an ethical point of view are?
Yeah, I guess the main thing I would say is don't do that. that seems a little bit simpler. No, but I think that the kind of work that Mary Beth and groups like this are doing is wonderful, because it is true that while many of us are thinking about these sort of grand institutional things or things earlier in the process, there are a lot of ways that we can make life much better for companion animals by working directly with people who live with them or people in communities to do basic things that they might not thinking about. People might love their animals, and they might want them to have good lives, but maybe they were raised in a culture where it was typical to leave your dog outside or to leave your dog in a hot car or to tether your dog. And it's easy in that situation to make the assumption that this is what is in their interest or this is the natural or typical way to interact with them. And so I just think that raising these questions and presenting people with basic facts about what is needed for dogs to have minimally decent lives can move a lot of people. And then they can discover that without too much inconvenience for them, they can bring their dog inside when the weather is really bad. They can make their dog less socially isolated. They can make sure not to leave their dog in a hot car. Those little things, which I think almost everybody, if they think about it for 5 minutes, is on board with, whether or not they identify as an animal activist in a more extreme sense of that term, focusing on those issues can help us make a big difference.
Are there breeds of dog that are just prone to being more dangerous for humans? Jeff Sebo.
So this is a matter of debate among scientists, and so I don't want to say anything definitively about that. But I think an emerging consensus is that the answer is not really. There are not really breeds who are more prone to violence. There are certain breeds who have reputations for that. Bully breeds, especially pit bulls, have a reputation for being more prone to violence. But the general thinking these days is that the reason for that has much more to do with how these members of those breeds are socialized and treated by humans. So we socialize them in a certain way, we treat them in a certain way that draws out a violent disposition, and then we blame them for having that disposition, and we say any member of that breed is going to be violent like these individuals are. But it seems much more likely to be the case that members of any breed, if raised in the right way in a loving household, can and likely will become a loving, nonviolent member of your family. And so when it comes to breeding, the more important questions are questions about the animal welfare conditions of breeding facilities, as well as what our priorities in breeding are. For example, are we breeding animals who are going to have respiratory problems or joint problems because we want them to have puppy-like features throughout their lives in ways that cause welfare problems down the line?
What's an example of that, Jeff Sebo, a breed that is bred to remain puppy-like and then they wind up having some of those health problems?
So I'm not sure what specific breed would be best to single out, but I can say that there is this general thing that happens where people like animals who look like puppies or kittens for their entire lives, and so those are the features that are bred for, but they do correlate with having respiratory problems because your nose gets smushed up and you have difficulty breathing, or joint problems because your body has a sort of unnatural proportion. And this is a something that companion animals share in common with farmed animals. In both cases, these individuals are bred to have features that are useful for us. In the case of farmed animals, they grow as big as possible, as quickly as possible. And in the case of companion animals, they look the way we want them to look, or they have a docility that we want them to have. But that tends to have negative health impacts. The challenge is to think about breeding priorities, insofar as we breed animals at all, that serve their well-being in addition to ours.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about the ethics around human treatment of animals, particularly companion animals, and the existing ordinances. Our guests today, Jeff Sebo, Research Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC, Mary Beth Mount, Vice President of AFAR, Advocates for Animal Rights in Brunswick County, and Captain Mose Highsmith, Staff Attorney in the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office. They're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. Linda from Calabash, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I would like to know what the general population who are dog lovers can do to get the attention of a representative in Raleigh to pass some laws, especially for tethering laws, that would help protect these animals.
Linda, are you involved at all in animal welfare groups or the animal advocacy movement?
Well, not specifically, but I do foster and I do volunteer at the Brunswick shelter in Supply.
Well, thank you for doing that. And Mary Beth Mount, how would someone who just happens to be a dog lover engage in this process of getting legislation passed? Thanks so much for your call, Linda.
Well, certainly that's what AFAR is looking to do, is to make any changes in legislation at this point locally, and we don't know where we might move from there.
You're focused on Brunswick County right now. Is that right?
That is correct.
A county ordinance is what you're after.
That is correct. Yeah.
Will you pursue state legislation at some point?
Because there will be some legislation coming up in the state that we will be interested in, because it will affect animal welfare, yes, we will certainly look to get our representative to support that legislation. And that is what I would recommend to Linda and anyone else who wanted to, she said, get the attention of legislators, make those phone calls, write letters, send emails, let them know how you feel and that you want them to support certain pieces of legislation that affect these animals. Pay attention to what's going on and make your wishes known.
Captain Highsmith, what is an observation that a resident in Brunswick County might be able to make about their neighbor? If a neighbor is concerned about a treatment of a companion animal, what is the kind of thing that would trigger the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office to launch an investigation?
Well, we're going to respond to any call from a citizen. And so we would encourage citizens, if they see an animal or see, not just limited to animals, if they see something in the community, it goes back to the if you see something, say something. And so that applies to animals, suspected drug use, suspected child abuse. Call us and we'll send the appropriate person to take a look. Now, just because you call doesn't necessarily mean that you see a difference right away. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we didn't do something. You know, we get calls from people who want to, for example, report what they think is drug dealing in the neighborhood. And then 2 weeks go by and the same in and out traffic is still happening. They think nothing happened. Well, we may have charged somebody. That may not have stopped the problem. In the case of issues regarding animals, we may have talked to the owner. We may have tried to educate the owner on what to do differently, and they may not have done it. So
now, would you educate an owner, and I'm, you know, using your term, in a case that in which you couldn't prosecute or charge someone with animal cruelty? In other words, if, say, someone left a dog out in the backyard when temperatures dropped below freezing, Is that something the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office would address?
You know, so the short answer to that is yes. We would rather help people become better pet owners than to take their pet away from them and put them in the shelter, because that is ultimately not good for the dog or for the person or the person's children, who really don't control the care of the dog. So if we can do something to help educate pet owners, we want to do that. Now, having said that, if the case is extreme cruelty, we're not going to leave an animal in a situation where it's further tortured or subjected to bad conditions. And so in that case, we may take the animal into the shelter, charge the person, leave it up to the courts to educate through a sentencing structure.
And is that something that you would consider cruelty, leaving a dog in the backyard when it's there's some kind of extreme weather?
Boy, now you're asking
me
hard questions.
That's what I'm trying to get at, is what some of the circumstances, what is an absolute, yes, this would trigger consequences, this is sort of a gray area, this, no. It may offend you, but no.
So the state statute and the state ordinance talk about situations that inflict pain on the animal, subject the animal to prolonged harsh conditions, such as rain and snow and excessive heat and those kind of things. And so is it a potential that could be cruelty? Yes. Is it also a potential that it could be an educatable situation? Yes.
Okay. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking today about ethics and animals, particularly where companion animals are concerned. When we come back from this 90-second break, you'll have one more segment to call in and ask your question. You can reach us today by email at coastline@whqr.org. You can also give us a call at 910-343-1138. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're exploring the current standards of treatment of companion animals, mostly dogs and cats, and whether humans' ideas around these protocols are changing. Our guests today, Jeff Sebo, Research Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Parr Center for Ethics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Mary Beth Mount, Vice President of AFAR, Advocates for Animal Rights in Brunswick County, and Captain of Legal Affairs for the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office, Mose Highsmith. They're answering your questions on this Thursday. You can reach us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Captain Highsmith, you were explaining the kinds of circumstances that might trigger an investigation from the sheriff's office, whether it's actually an offense that needs enforcement or whether this is a teachable moment for an animal owner. So can you kind of talk about what the actual law is and then how you interpret that?
Okay. So the law requires owners to provide three things: food, water, and shelter. So long as those three things are provided and the animal is not subjected to conditions that cause the animal pain or suffering, then the owner is acting within the law. The law doesn't require animal owners to provide a bed in front of the fireplace. You know, I mean, that's an extreme example.
Right.
But if a dog has shelter, then the question is the shelter adequate? Now, the county ordinance provides some examples of things that are not adequate. And those examples are explicit. Allowing the dog to be under a vehicle as shelter is not acceptable. Allowing the dog to go under the steps for shelter, according to the ordinance, is not acceptable. Metal barrels that could be subjected to direct sunlight, not acceptable. cardboard boxes as shelter, not acceptable. So, but those are examples. Those aren't all inclusive. And so then it becomes the function of the animal control officer, if a person calls in with concerns about shelter, for example, to go out and assess the situation. And so it could be that we could talk to the owner and say, this cardboard box isn't acceptable. Could you get a plastic igloo doghouse or something? That might be a resolution if that's the only issue, you know, cardboard box. Now, we may go and find that might be the factor that got us there, but that there are other issues we need to look at, and we're certainly not going to turn a blind eye to the other issues once we're there.
Mary Beth Mount of AFAR, what role will AFAR or other animal welfare organizations play in educating the public about standards of care?
Well, one of the things that we do hope to do in working with the Sheriff's Department and Animal Control is to kind of become that group which will help to educate people. In the instances where it's a cardboard box and they just need to understand that that is not adequate shelter, we would like to be able to go in and talk to these families and say, here, let's see if we can help you to construct something that is appropriate and within the law for your dog. Let's make sure that your dog can get to its food and water, that the food and water is fresh all of the time. Because sometimes that's all that it takes, is to help people to understand that what they're doing just isn't quite enough. So that's certainly a role we would like to play in assisting animal control.
And just from a philosophical point of view, Jeff Sebo, there are people who say, and this is according to, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition, human beings have dominion over the natural world, over all of the animals. And why are we talking about animal welfare when there are so many people in the world that need help first, that are suffering, that aren't treated well, that are victims of abuse or worse? What do you say to that?
So there are a bunch of interesting questions that get raised there. One is a purely religious question. I'm not a religious scholar, so I'm not an expert on this. But I do know that recently many people in the Judeo-Christian tradition have been challenging traditional interpretations of dominion over nature. So, for example, Matthew Scully, a former Bush speechwriter, published a book called Dominion, where he argued that on an appropriate understanding of what the Bible was saying, we should interpret dominion more as stewardship and responsibility for non-human animals in the environment rather than absolute control and a right to use them however we see fit. So even within the religious tradition, some understandings are shifting along those lines. But more generally, I think I would say the same kinds of things, or people in animal ethics generally are inclined to say the same types of things that we do when people compare human oppressions, when people argue that we should focus on this oppressed group of humans rather than that oppressed group of humans. I think the best thing to say in those cases is that these are all very important issues. We should be focusing on all of them. And these types of harm are in various ways linked. So as a standard example, and I know that you have done previous shows on this topic, but briefly, industrial animal agriculture is responsible for lots of harm to workers, very significant public health risks, and is the among the leading global contributors to human-caused climate change. So addressing that issue doubles as a way of addressing a lot of issues that very significantly impact humans as well.
So you're saying I think that there's a correlation between mm-hmm. welfare of animals and welfare of people. Yeah. Do you think mm-hmm. there's a correlation between the way a culture or a society treats their animals versus the way they treat one another?
I think there is. And this is another example where these types of harms can be linked. So, for example, there's a lot of research that indicates that when people abuse non-human animals, that makes them more inclined to be violent towards humans as well. And in general, when we teach people that they can dominate any other sentient being at all, that can cultivate attitudes that will make people likely to try to dominate other human beings too. So a general thought is that, yes, human and non-human arms are linked in these very practical ways, like climate change, but more fundamentally they're linked because if we want to be – if we want to treat other humans well, then we need to cultivate general attitudes that lead us to not try to oppress or marginalize any type of being at all, including non-human animals. And once we do that, then we can really treat everybody with the dignity that they deserve.
When you talk about the oppression of non-human animals, I think – or dominance over them – I think about dogs, and I mm-hmm. think about the dog whisperer, and I think about how he has raised awareness of the importance of humans being the alpha dog in the situation. Am I conflating concepts here? Can you help me sort of tease this out? Because what, you know, sorry, it's a reference from pop culture, but
it
still is a guy who said you'll get along with these guys better if you act as the alpha dog, and if you and they'll be safer among themselves and among human beings. So is there a divergence there in philosophy or not?
Yeah, that's a great question. So briefly, there are debates among animal trainers whether we should be using positive or negative reinforcement strategies for training dogs. And so his particular way of becoming the alpha in his pack is controversial among people who are dog trainers. But with that said, I think you make a really great point, which is that we need to – part of respecting animals is respecting the kinds of social hierarchies that they construct and the ways that they experience the world. I know my dog, Smokey, is a super beta. he does need his human companions to take charge. And so part of respecting Smokey and treating him with dignity and not dominating him in the bad sense of the term, that might involve taking charge in a good sense of the term so that he can feel comfortable in our pack. So I think that you're absolutely right that treating different individuals with respect, that doesn't mean you treat everybody exactly the same. It means you treat everybody in ways that will promote their own well-being. And that might, of course, look very different for humans and non-human animals and different species of non-human animals.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about the ethics around human treatment of animals, particularly companion animals. Jeff Sebo, Research Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Associate Director of the Parr Center for Ethics at UNC Chapel Hill, is with us today. Mary Beth Mount, Vice President of AFAR Advocates for Animal Rights in Brunswick County, and Captain Mose Highsmith, Staff Attorney in the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office. They're answering your questions on this Thursday. You have just a few minutes left to give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Jim from Oak Island, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. Last spring, my 23-pound Sheltie was out in the front yard of our house behind an invisible fence. I mean, he was contained. And I looked out the window and saw a female pit bull out there with him. I went out, and no sooner did I get out there than the pit bull attacked my dog. I was able to get the pit bull off the dog, and the dog ran into the house. My dog ran into the house. I called the police, and I stayed outside with the pit bull to make sure that, you know, I knew where the dog was when they showed up. First words out of the police officer's mouth was, "Oh, I know that dog, up on, you know, a block away from me. And he or she has attacked two other dogs that this police officer knew about." Okay, long story short, we had over $1,300 in vet bills. We sent a letter to the dog owner saying, you know, we're going to have to we would like you to pay these bills. And the owner moved out of state. My question was, and by the way, the pit bull was euthanized as a result of this incident, and that makes me feel not very good, okay?
That wasn't satisfactory.
I think the owner should be in jail.
Mm-hmm. Let's toss this over to Captain Highsmith with the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office. The ordinances vary from municipality to municipality, do they not?
They do.
How would the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office handle a situation like that?
Gosh, you know, I'm not going to get into backyard or Monday morning quarterback and how another agency handled an issue, and I'm not familiar with what the county ordinance, or I'm sorry, what the city ordinance for Oak Island is and what the circumstances were at the time. I can say generally that the remedy for the medical bills and I would encourage this owner to contact an attorney, because certainly there are civil remedies available to recover the expense. Now that doesn't fix the heartache that comes with losing an animal. So I'm not sure what more I can say about that situation. But I'm very sorry it happened to you.
And you're mm-hmm. saying that civil action might be the only way left in terms of if he was actually going to continue to seek some sort of redress.
Well, yes. I mean, in the county, dogs can't run at large in the county. So that would be an opportunity for us to intervene. Now,
well, he said this happened a couple of times. So let's say in the county, the sheriff's office is called out on this. And let's say the sheriff's deputy reacts that way and says, oh, I know this dog, and we've cited this owner multiple times for letting their dog off the property and off a leash. What happens at that point? Is there any consequence?
Again, it's hard for me to try to fill in the blanks of that situation. But I will say one of the benefits that we've seen in the county with the sheriff's office having animal control is that we have, of the six animal control officers we have working in the field, four of them are sworn law enforcement officers. So they have investigative abilities. And because we're both under the same umbrella, we also have better communication. So I don't know if, you know, the fact that this officer may have been aware of a situation, did he communicate it to the right people to make sure something happened? I have no way of knowing.
Jim, thank you for your call, and I'm so sorry about that situation. Want to get to, we just have a minute or so left. If a dog is forced to hold its waist, and this might be a question for you, Jeff Sebo, by virtue of being housebroken and is not free to defecate at a point that is naturally required, is the dog in pain or in distress? And if so, is that animal cruelty? I think this is actually a good question for a lot of people who think they have their dogs trained to stay home during the day for 8 hours. What does an animal ethicist have to say about that?
Yeah, so I do think that those are really important questions, because there is a tendency to think that if I can train a dog to hold their bladder for 8 hours or to stay in a crate and not make too much noise for 7 hours, then everything is totally fine and our household and family are perfectly mutually advantageous. But that can be a pretty self-serving interpretation of things. So I do think that we should be skeptical of those convenient stories we tell ourselves about how well our animals are doing when we force them to adapt to our lifestyles. Whether a particular dog is doing well or badly in a particular situation, of course, is not really something I can say in the abstract.
I have an email, and I don't think we're going to have time to handle this whole thing, but Travis is describing a neighbor who left their dog outside ever since he's moved into his home a year ago. Freezing weather, extreme heat, looks incredibly unkempt. Water green. Captain Highsmith, should he contact the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office to find out what to do?
Absolutely. We'll have somebody come out and take a look.
Okay, sure. And we will post that information on our website also. That's this edition of Coastline. Mary Beth Mount, Jeff Sebo, and Captain Highsmith, thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Many thanks also to UNC for making their studios available to us. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Caleb Covington engineered today's show. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast on iTunes. Join us for Coastline live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.